Well, good evening, everybody. It is January 29th, and we are here for a campfire conversation. I've asked John Moorhead, a friend of mine, if he would join us. He's on with us now. If he would do this campfire conversation. And what you need to know is that John and I have spent, oh, boy, I bet you close to 3 hours on the phone, three different sessions the last 2 weeks. And I've recorded these, and I'm going to put together a several-session podcast on this. And so after our last time talking, I think it was last week, it might have been maybe Monday of last week, not this one, before the retreat, I'll tell you what, I haven't stopped thinking about the things that I've heard John sharing about his perspective on life, on his marriage, on his own heart, on God, on heaven, on eternity, on the kingdom of God here. And John Hart knows this well because I don't think I stopped talking about my conversations with John since he picked me up at the airport and all the way through the retreat. Just the things that he said that have so stirred my heart and continue to do it. You know, if you see a movie and it's really good, that movie story stays with you for a long time, and that's what these conversations have done. So I asked John Moorhead if he would do a live campfire conversation with us. And so, John, first, thank you so much for doing this with us. I know it can be tough in these days, let alone that it's 8 o'clock at night there. I'm still sitting at 6 o'clock, so thank you for doing this with us.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honor, Gary.
Yeah. So let me say this, and then I'm going to ask you a question. John and I met, gosh, I don't know, what year was that we met at Wild at Heart? Do you remember?
2001, October of 2001.
Oh, my goodness. That must have been one of the first ones we've ever done. It had to be the first one or the second.
It was the second, I think.
Okay, that's amazing. And you just told me, you reminded me, now if I got this wrong, correct me. I'll be embarrassed, but correct me. I think I heard you say that during the, after the wound session, you know, we'll typically invite guys to stay if they would like, and several of us will come around, we'll just pray over you. We won't really get in a conversation, but we'll just ask God how to pray for you and pray for you. And I came over and prayed for you. Is that right?
That was later in 2007.
Oh,
but
okay,
if you want to go down,
I wasn't even praying back then.
Yeah, you. In 2001, you did have a deep impact on me, and that's a whole other story. But I came back multiple times, and God used you in a powerful way. 2007 was when you specifically came and prayed with me, and I received deep inner healing. That was amazing.
That is amazing. That amazes me. That's so fun to hear. So John, as there are some questions we want to ask you, but before we do that, kind of bring us into your present life. You know, and present could be the last 6 months, the last year, could be the last several weeks, wherever you want to go with that, but give us a sense of your current journey so we'll have a feel for what you're speaking from.
Yeah, I've got... I've been battling cancer for 9 years. It was February of 2006 that I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. I needed emergency surgery and bowel surgery at that time, but it had already spread to both of my lungs at that time. And over the past 9 years, I've been involved in a couple of, well, actually three different rounds of chemo and seven different surgeries doing what they call cherry picking, just removing all the cancer that popped up. And I had a wonderful 2.5 year interval of no detectable disease. Felt essentially normal for my age, and had hopes that it wouldn't come back. But then in March of last year, which is about 10 months ago, my usual six-month scan showed that it had come back with a vengeance in both lungs, and was essentially terminal. The only thing that could be done was chemo, and I had decided previously that I wasn't going to go that way, just simply because I had learned what it was like to be alive and not living, and I just didn't want to go there. I have had the best 10 months of my entire life these past 10 months. I have no regrets. And I also want to add very quickly that obviously everybody has to walk out these decisions and their battles on their own. And I can only share what happened to me. But so the past 3 months or so, my symptoms of cough and shortness of breath have been pretty rapidly progressing after being relatively minor until then. And I'm at the point now where, as you can hear, I'm pretty much speaking in short sentences. I'm fine when I sit still, but my activity is severely limited, and I'm on oxygen all the time now. But I want to add very quickly that how I sound in my staccato voice and everything and how this body's wearing out is not at all related to what's been going on inside of me. And as I told Gary, it's hard to talk about because I feel like I'm growing younger, actually, on the inside. And I feel like, and I struggle for words here, but it has to do with a deeper sense of life, a deeper sense of vitality, even while this body is wasting away. And I look at it as probably the beginning of the separation. You know, it's just the eternal kind of life. We just keep going. And I think I'm having previews of coming attractions. I'm just experiencing everything at a very much deeper and richer level, and that ranges from my conversations with God to simple kindnesses, kisses from my wife, the feel of sand on my feet, my experience of beauty, and my eyes to detect it. I see beauty in simple things like I never saw before. I have waves of the anticipation of goodness coming over me all the time. I'm very optimistic. I, of course, am in a place where I'm grieving the pain of those that I love that they'll experience when I'm gone, but it's not related to my personal grief. So I think I'll stop there. And just, you know, let the conversation go where it wants. But that's sort of an overview of where I am.
And I can tell you myself that what has struck me, and I've heard you say it just now and in the earlier conversations, is there is a sense in me that there is a deeper belief that things do get better in eternity, that it is true that everything is brighter and bigger and more life. I mean, just as you're telling me that you're already kind of getting a taste of this, that's remarkable to me. The other thing that struck me was when you told me, and this is before we started getting into these conversations, that you would email me, but you said something like, you know, this last year of my life, I have more intensely and accurately lived out the calling of my life, the weightiness, the glory of my life, than ever before. But you mix that in with the description of where you were with cancer and the battle of that, and I was so taken by that. So describe that for a minute, this idea that you feel like you're more aware of your calling, the glory of your life, and offering it in a greater way as ever before. How is that?
Yeah, and I remember us talking about that, and I think something I said was how important belief is, and it's one thing to indulge the truths, and you articulate them so well about our original glory and the weight of who we are and how unique we are and what we have to offer. But there's always this little shadow of a doubt. There's always this little rim of not being able, even though we want to, not being able to 100% sit down in that. And what I want to say is that there's hope that as time has gone on here, and particularly the past 9 years, and as I have been battling more and more with cancer and the truth that we all know that, you know, this mortal body is not going to make it. Nobody makes it with this body into eternity. But as that went deeper and deeper, I was freed up to believe more and more and to see better and better what my glory was. And to hear, you know, Gary, I've complimented you on this, and I think it's so such a rich exercise to continually visit those voices, you know, and being honest before God about, okay, this is what I'm feeling is true about me, right? And you lay that out. And many times there, it's not true. It's a pushback. But then you ask God, okay, that's what I think. What do you think of me? And that is where the strength comes. That is where our glory rises from, as we receive an affirmation of what we know to be true, but we doubt somehow. And as that rises up and we indulge that and live from it, then we find it experientially to be true. And so that's what's been going on with me, particularly the past couple of years, but the last 9 years in a graded fashion, is that I have been testing it. I've been leaning into it. I've been putting my full weight, okay, you have given me this name, I see this, and you have shown me examples of how I've lived this in my life. And so now today, I'm going to live out of that. And then finding that not only to be true and bless others with it, but also be just incredibly strengthened by it and to grow and to experience this deep, deep joy.
So, John, if you have a question, because
I was going to ask. Well, you know, John, I watched the video some that Gary and you had been creating, and one of the things that struck me was the you seem to have this vast reservoir of joy. Your face just exhibits joy. Your voice does. You would laugh, and it was like a laugh that just came from a deep place of joy. And I wondered how much of that was true for you years ago and how much of that is really the result of what you're going through now.
That's a great question, John, and thank you for asking. It was buried. It was always in there, but it was buried. And you know what? I think that that's true for all of us. When Christ comes to live in us, what kind of words can you use to describe that, what that is? Certainly a large part of it is joy, because it comes from peace and freedom and coming alive and security, eternally secure, no condemnation. All the walls come down between us and our Heavenly Dad. And so there's this tremendous deep-seated joy, and it is assaulted. And as I mentioned to Gary before, at that way back at that first boot camp in 2001, we were all warned that our life was about to get a lot harder, and I had no idea. But a lot of that was a direct assault against joy. Because joy, as it manifests itself naturally, as it just flows out, it's powerful for the kingdom, and so we get opposed.
What would you say to, you know, somebody like me? I'm 60 years old, and I'm sitting here thinking, well, I've probably got 20, 30 years left, and you know, I'm healthy and things are going well, but I don't experience joy like what I see in you. What would you say to me?
There's a quote. let me collect myself for a minute, because that, again, that's a very rich question. And so how can we sort of facilitate the release? I think I can only speak for myself, but I'm a retired physician, and I was very left-brained, and I came to conclusions about life and everything else, and it was hard for me to back off of those. But there's a book written by a guy named Brian Draper, and I quoted this to Gary in one of our talks, and I should have referenced it because it was his quote actually that said it. He says, we will never realize what life has to offer until we let go of what we believe it should offer.
Mm.
And I'm not sure I had that those specific words in my mind, but when I was diagnosed with cancer and went before God, my intimacy with Him went in a direction which I had never dreamed it could go. There was an intimacy with Him that was available that I never realized was available.
Would you repeat that quote one more time? That was really good.
That quote?
Yeah, we will never discover.
We'll never find what life has to offer until we let go of our ideas about what life should offer, of what we think life should offer.
That is really good.
And it was when I was sort of forced to do that. I mean, when you're diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and it's all through you. I mean, when I was diagnosed, my 5-year survival was probably statistically around 30 or 35%, and that was with all the treatment and everything. So it was on me, and I had a great sense of urgency, and those simple little prayers just didn't work very well anymore. And as I tried to structure my prayers, I almost went into despair, because I felt like somehow or another I had to phrase my prayers right, and nothing worked. So this is a long conversation in itself, and I'm not sure, you know, everybody has to walk this out on their own. But what I would say that was the beginning of my joy, which was beyond understanding, of peace that was beyond understanding. But the joy was most noticeable because it was irrational, and everybody's head got turned. And the reason why I was walking around giddy and a smile on my face was, number one, I had discovered a way to be intimate with my heavenly dad that I didn't know existed. And number two, the fruit of that intimacy led to more intimacy, so that all these coincidences begin happening. I read The Divine Conspiracy about that time. I'm a big Dallas Willard fan. And he says, love wants to be known, and the more we look for it, i.e. God's love, God working in our lives, the more we'll see it. And so it got to be a beautiful feedback. I'd get this tremendous joy, and it seemed like God was so full of joy with my joy that He would just bless me with some unexpected circumstance, and then I would see Him in that, and I'd be overwhelmed, and then it would repeat itself. And that is what really has been going on.
So with that, one of the things that struck me as we had talked earlier was this idea. I mean, you just talked about, I'm paraphrasing you, and I hope I'm doing it fairly well, how well, I can't say more well, better you're loving your wife now, how easier you're offering what's in your heart to others. And part of what you said was this idea that you kind of have nothing to lose anymore. You don't have to defend yourself. You don't have to uphold an image. You don't. There's just nothing. So you were telling me. You said, "Listen, I can listen to another person's story, and I don't have to think about my story, and I don't have to worry about how that story affects my story." You were talking about this freedom from the way you love people to the things that don't bother you anymore. Touch on that for a minute, because that really struck me.
Yeah, I wish that I could say that there was some sort of magic formula or something. This just came flowing towards me. It was when I sought that I believe God was good, and that I believe that He wanted to relate to me in deeper ways than He had. I didn't understand, and I didn't feel like I needed to understand everything about my disease. I got over that pretty quick. But from that came everything else. And what I found was, it's almost like I'm standing outside of myself and watching myself change from the inside out. And I think what you referred to, Gary, was finally beginning to, you know, getting rid of that false self that we walk around with, the one that seeks the approvals of others, and you know, that really is what happened. I was intentional about that for years and years and years, and then it seemed like a fruit of my intimacy and love affair, if you will, with God, was that just fell off. And nothing else mattered. And I wish I could, like I say, I wish I could tell you how to get there. But the key is to practice the presence of God, to believe that there is much more in walking with Him and experiencing life with Him day in and day out, and just giving Him an opportunity to show up and frankly, risk a little bit. Because you get misunderstood. People think you're weird.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, Vern just asked a really good question. He says, John, could you have advised your 2001 self of a means of intimacy without the current reality as a lens?
Could you repeat that, please? Part of it was muffled.
Could you have advised your 2001 self of a means of intimacy without the current reality as a lens?
The current reality of a what?
Without the current reality as a lens. In other words, how would you tell your 2001 self about this intimacy without having to go through the cancer? And
yeah.
Yep.
At the 2001 boot camp in a breakout session, the challenge was to go out up on a mountain and ask God what He thought of you. At that point in time, I did not believe that God spoke. And I remember that afternoon like it was yesterday. I almost didn't do the exercise because I was so terrified. I had a father that was very, very distant, and I was never a beloved son. And I was absolutely convinced that if I took that question to my Heavenly Father, there would be no answer. I had never heard God speak to me, and I didn't know how it worked or anything like that, but I remember walking up above the camp. It was at Frontier, and I was literally shaking. I was crying so hard, I was shaking. And I sat down, and I felt like I was 5 years old, and I felt like I had in a puddle, and I felt like either He was going to answer me or I was going to die. Because there wasn't any hope if He didn't answer. And He spoke. And to my surprise, He spoke and gave me the beginning of a name. He identified some traits in how He made me and my original glory that were just stunning. And they were upside down. They were the exact opposite of what I thought of myself. And again, Gary, that you sort of held that out as an example, you and some others too, because you had, from the front, I heard these examples of when we condemn ourselves, or some voice comes and names us or says something about us that's not true, and then we look to God and the answer is different. So back in 2001, that was the beginning. That was the beginning. And you can I don't know how to say that happened. It was grace. I mean, I think I stepped into that. It was risky. That was the riskiest thing I'd ever done in my life, was to go up by myself, no posing, just naked, and basically say, if you don't show up, I'm dead. And he showed up. And so I got a foothold. That was the beginning of the journey, and there have been a lot of battles, and I have indulged a lot of lies, and there have been a lot of periods of time when I just chose not to ask him what he thought of me. But the truth is that the journey was two steps forward and one step back since that time. So I guess intentionality and risk is a large part of it.
Yeah, and I'm what I'm taking is that now the question that I feel kind of swirls around your heart is, well, what's there to risk, really? What's really at risk here?
Yeah.
Except for what
yeah.
you don't offer, you know, of yourself.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, because I want to be good with our time with you, but Jeff Andrejian asked on the chat line on Basecamp, he asked us, this is such a great question, he just said simply, what are the three things that he would want us to know, things that he learned?
I think certainly risk is at the top. If I had, and again, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about this because I don't know to what extent somebody in their 30s is capable of risking. But certainly I played it safe and it held me back. And I would risk a lot more when I was younger and growing up, and especially in relationships, I would risk standing. But I think the second thing, and maybe more important, is to risk praying the prayer, asking for more faith. I actually, after the first boot camp, I was a mess, and I went to my church, which will remain unnamed, and I said, the one thing that I need to go forward is more faith, and I'm going to be intentional about asking God for more faith. And believe it or not, one of the elders said, oh, I'm not sure that's a good idea. You better be careful what you ask for. And that really pissed me off, and it motivated me in a really, really good way, because then it became a question as to whether God was good or not. And so that's what... I think things really began to shift big time when I sat down. I said, no matter what, I believe you are good. And because of that, and because of you, Jesus, and that there's nothing between us now, I ask for more faith. And I know that you will only give me what's good. And I don't know what that's going to look like, but I want more faith. And I think that he was faithful to answer that. Mm-hmm. So that would be the second thing. And the third thing is... I wouldn't take myself so seriously.
Now, meaning what when you say that?
My story. I wouldn't insist that the world accommodate my story.
Mm.
You know, that everything has to be so that I don't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have talked about this. The only way faith grows is in adversity. And I fought that for most of my life. And finally, when I get cancer, and there were some other major things that went on that are kind of personal, and I don't want to talk about them, but they were very, very big things in my personal life at the same time I had cancer. But that, out of that came this intimacy with God and this growth of faith and life. So, and as I look back on it, I was just trying to protect myself with posing and pretending I was somebody else and all that. And I wasn't, I just, I was just, I wasn't secure in the love of God. I wasn't resting in the love of God.
John, do you have something? Otherwise, I've got something.
Go ahead. I've got one, but it really is more like last question, so go ahead.
Okay. So real quickly, one of the things you and I talked about, I was very intrigued by this. I had told you, and a lot of these guys had heard this other campfire conversation that we did with a friend who, as I told you, is a American airline pilot, and he talked about, you know, when he first became captain, his wife was flown out to the school out there, and they sat down with the wives and said, you need to understand that the very thing that makes your husband a good captain is the very thing that's going to make your marriage hard.
Yeah.
And we want him to stay the way he is because it makes him a good pilot. And he was just saying that was kind of a stunning revelation. And then we talked about you as a physician, and you started talking about the things that you first approach it as some of the safeguards you'd set up in your life, or you could talk about in terms of posing. We could call them the same things. But I'd like you to talk about that briefly, but we talked about this idea that, you know, we don't have to give up what makes us good in our profession unless it's not who we are. But we need to understand that our life is bigger than that, and sometimes we make our performance at work our entire life, and we shut down the rest of our heart when we're outside of work, and that's where people go, I don't like being around you. You're whatever that is. So can you just talk about that briefly, this whole idea?
Yeah. I was a very insecure physician. A lot of physicians are that way. And a very common way of handling that is what I term the white coat syndrome. I always wore a long, heavily starched white coat with my name in script across the front pocket and a stethoscope around my neck. And I presented a picture of don't ask me anything. You'd better not ask me anything. I'm the authority. I've got the weight. And I think I told you, Gary, the way that fleshed itself out was I came on as a perfectionist and pushing my own insecurities onto others. I hurt a lot of people. I made nurses cry and everything. I was a real son of a bitch. But then as I now looking back and I see how I grew, I see that actually was a sort of a convolution of my compassion. What was driving my perfectionism was compassion. I really cared for my patients, and I didn't want anything bad to happen to them, and I wanted everything to go perfectly. So it was just it was convoluted and corrupted. And as I saw that, and I allowed, as you said, the rest of my heart to grow, I don't know why I thought this, but I think a lot of us do. We think that we are a type of person, and that's who we are. Like, you know, I've got an Irish temper, or I'm just made that way, or my dad's the same, or whatever. We just sit down in a certain identity. Well, that's, you know, that's at least lazy, and it's cowardly, because look at the way Jesus lived. He approached every situation and every person differently. He was a complex and wonderful person, and you couldn't put him in some sort of cookie cutter. You couldn't describe him with a few words, and that is available to us. But we tend to shut down large parts of our heart. And again, I think that has to do with some sort of agreement we make and thinking that life should be a certain way, and if it's not, we're going to make it that way.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, John, go ahead. We're at the end of our time, so this is good. So
yeah.
John Hart, go ahead.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
This is better.
Yes, I can.
Okay, I know my phone was kind of muffled. I'm just sitting here thinking, as you look back on your whole life, I'm curious, what brings the biggest smile to your face?
You're going to make me cry. I am in a season right now where there are more smiles per hour than there have ever been in my life. And I think how do I say this? All the things that made me smile through the richness of my experiences in living at this point in my life now seem 10 times richer. And I see the fruit of them. And I see how uniquely I was wired to be fed by them and strengthened by them. And most importantly, I experienced the love of God in every single memory. I think at this point in my life, and I shared with Gary, I have the best relationship with my wife that I've ever had. And I never dreamed it could be like this. I never imagined that. And who would? Who would imagine that the sweetest experience of a kiss in your entire life would be when you're almost 69 years old? It just is so, I mean, that's not what life is, should be like. I mean, you guys fill in the blank, but I never would have dreamed that. And yet, because of what has happened and the way God has used adversity in our lives, there is something between us which is so unique and not of this world that it brings a sense of joy and deep, deep gratitude that I just, nothing was ever close.
Thank you.
Yeah. And by the way, John, so you know, I posted the picture of the front of that magazine of you and your wife on the beach.
Oh, cool.
What a beautiful picture. What a beautiful wife you have.
Thank you. Yeah, I think so.
So thank you so much for this time. This has been so good. And I'm telling you, we could turn this into an hour easily, like when you and I get on the phone midday, you know.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing this so much.
Thank you for asking me.
And I want to say to you in front of everyone that, you know, over the years, and I've told you this before, but I just want to say this in front of everyone, you have been this man who I have talked to, we've probably talked once or twice a year, just kind of almost haphazardly. Somehow we'd email each other and get on the phone and again, whether that communication was by email or it was on the phone, we're hearing each other's voice. You have always given me, imparted to me, this deep sense of encouragement, not just happiness and, you know, an energy, but actually a deep sense of encouragement about my life, about God, about my place in this kingdom. It really, you just emitted this every time we talked, and it was rather infrequent, but that's just who you are, and I'm so grateful for that, and I am really grateful for the last, you know, several conversations we've had, because your words have gone very deep. And like I said, I just keep hearing your voice and thinking through what you've been saying. So thank you.
Well, Gary, it's been my pleasure, and thank you. It's been so easy to encourage you because you are one of those men out there who are carrying a message of truth that is part of the full gospel that brings life and reminds everyone that there is more. There's more life available now. And you point men in the right direction. You point people in the right direction. I'm deeply thankful for what you do.
Thank you. Thank you. John Moorhead, thank you so much for this call. John Hart, thanks for doing this with me. And everyone listening, thank you. And good night.
Good night, everybody.